The exhibition is Identity and Restraint, The Art of the Dog Collars. It features a collection of 63 dog collars from the 16th century to modern day, collected by Tim Greenan, who had given them to the National Sporting Library and Museum in Middleburg. Several years ago, we decided to do an exhibition jointly with the Sporting Library and Museum, and we supplied the paintings and they supplied the collars. So it's great to see them together.
You were saying that because of your own past in this business that a lot of these objects were old friends of yours?
Yes, did the dog and art auction for Doyle and Bonhams beginning in 1999 and ran it for about 17 years. And a couple of collections of dog collars came up in the early 2000s or so. So I've sold these and offered them and then subsequently helped the museum in Middleburg appraise them. And now they're back here with our artwork.
Can you talk a little about the concept? The title is quite provocative, Identity and Restraint.
Collars have two functions. One is to help identify the dogs. Now we have chips, but in those days you might have a collar, but also restraint to keep them wandering off. Maybe an imbalance in the relationship between the human and canine, but it does help the canine from maybe getting into accidents or be lost.
Now, some of these are marvelously elegant. At what point did they stop being merely functional and clearly become also decorative?
Oh, I think they were ornate and decorative pretty much from the beginning, particularly with greyhounds. If you go to the unicorn tapestries at the cloisters or any old medieval manuscript, the greyhounds were the most prized dogs, and they had the most elegant and colorful collars.
Were there family patterns? Horses were often comparisoned in the colors of their owners. Was there anything like that in dogs?
Some emblems here and there, really starting towards the 18th century, engraved names of the dog, of the master, his address, so it has a functionality of getting the dog back.
Describe a couple of these for me. Tell me about the one we're standing in front of now.
Well, this is a 18th century hammered metal with a gilt wash on it. Another one below it has some springing dogs through there. They're all elegantly embossed and engraved. Some have little bells on them as well.
Is this a three-part collar here or three different collars?
No, three different collars. What's interesting, we have a display of locks. Especially in the 19th century, dog napping was very popular. Stealing the dog and either dyeing his coat and reselling him or ransom.
I'm sorry to say that the modern comparison that occurs to me is hot wheeling. What, you steal the car and then you take it apart for parts because that's safer?
I don't think you take the dog apart.
Now, you've talked about the greyhound tradition, which we're all familiar with, those very striking taller collars. Pugs also had a collar tradition with the bells, and also cows. How did that come about?
It became popular in the 18th century, particularly because of the Meissen factory in porcelain. And on the continent, the pug was the most celebrated dog, and apparently there was a society of pugs, not unlike the Masons. And the pugs that were produced by the Meissen porcelain factory had wide circulation, and they often had the bells on their collars.
Are there any contemporary fashions like this? Did Tiffany or Cartier go into collars?
You see them occasionally. We have a Tiffany collar in the collection, which has a New York City dog license of 1884, the year the American Kennel Club was founded.
Oh, that's really charming. Is that on this floor or upstairs?
I'd have to look around. I'm not sure where I put it.
Some of them look a little bit like crowns.
Over here, we have sort of the genesis, the iron collars, the spiky collars. They were very pragmatic. These were hunting dogs. We have a large lion hunt up here with dogs with collars that protected their vulnerable neck from boars and bears and lions. Well, not really lions. They didn't have them in Europe, but fanciful lions. But they were protected by these very functional collars. And then that function gradually receded, and the spikes you see on the proverbial cartoon bulldog, they're sort of vestigial. They had a point at one time, but they don't any longer.
So a little bit like suits of armor, which were meant to intimidate as well as protect.
Exactly.
And was part of your task to choose paintings that illustrated some of this?
We worked together, the crew from Middleburg. I had them come up and show them around.
Take me closer to this one so we can see what it actually is, because it's pretty fearsome.
This is a painting in the manner of Paul DeVos, who was a very famous hunt scene painter of the 17th century Dutch period. And it shows these very violent dogs. This is a very mean, snarling mastiff with a fabulous silver collar with an inner velvet lining. And he's in a garden setting with a large capital. So this is a nobleman's dog. And they went to feeding him, and so they gave him a whole leg of a horse.
So not for the timid, this painting.
No. In fact, I was worried about putting it out, but it's what happened in those days, and it's interesting to know.
This is a striking piece. It looks almost like a piece of contemporary art.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's a chain link with spikes protruding. The chain link allows for the malleability of the collar to go around the neck, and then the spikes, obviously, their protection.
And I presume, as in other trajectories, as the dogs became more like companion animals, there was less ferocity and control and more about decoration.
Yeah, and we discussed that in the catalog. These are very earthy creatures capable of great brutality. But the landscape changes as the dog as pet in the living room becomes much more prevalent.
It's interesting to think that in the show ring, we're almost seeing a sleight of hand. The less color you have, the more vibrant your dog feels. There they are on those little pieces of string.
Exactly. I think the whole idea is to focus on the dog there, not the collar. I can imagine there was a time, I'd have to look back in the annals of the early dog shows, where people would try to outdo each other with diamond-studded collars.
Dog collar as big as the Ritz.
What you might want to look at is upstairs. Mm-hmm. We have a reproduction of a Anstel painting of the Waterloo Cup, and it shows a coursing collar, where it's two collars that hold two dogs at one time, and then when you pulled on the lead, they were released at the same time. So in coursing, you couldn't say that anyone got a better advantage or a distinct advantage.
How intriguing. Just the next floor up?
Yep.
Okay. Thank you so much. I'm going to find the man who brought this collection together.
The interesting thing is whenever I would tell anyone that I collected dog collars, they'd look at me like I had a crazy collection. Like I always say, like hotel room keys or matchbooks.
Laughing cows.
Right, it's because people today look at dog collars as something disposable. It's ephemera, and they don't realize that 19th and 18th, 17th, 16th century, dog collars, you know, they were mostly made of metal, bronze, copper, silver, leather, and they were more valuable than a dog. And in fact, like dog napping in the early 19th century was for the purpose of stealing a collar mostly, because dogs had no value, and the law saw them as having no value because no one understood the notion of a companion animal at that time. Towards the late 1880s or 1890s, you started to see pet shops, and then a dog collar became the first canine apparel, and you started to see the mass production. The quality was still good, and it wasn't until after World War II that you started to see like a decline in the quality of the dog collar. So as to why I got involved, about 20 years ago, I saw a collar advertised in the Maine Antique Digest, and it was a beautiful collar made out of pack tongue, an alloy that looks like silver, and it had the family name Woolsey on it, and it was just beautiful. It sort of spoke to me, and I realized that that represented the identity of a dog. And every subsequent collar told a story about a dog. And it's that dog's identity, not the name of the dog, because rarely was the name of the dog on the collar, but it told you what the dog's job was. Were they a hunting companion? Were they a dog that protected the flock in the field? Were they a companion animal? And the story of the dog collar is the story of man's relationship with the dog, which goes back, you know, 10,000 years to when they split off from the gray wolf, and hunters and gatherers realized, hey, this would be a good hunting companion, but I need to restrain them. And, you know, it's that concept of restraint. And that's why I got involved. And then I used to have this collection in my home in D.C., and my kids would take a collar and try to find that collar in one of Bill Secord's books, you know, with dog paintings. And they did like a Where's Waldo type thing. And kids like a story, and art tells a story, and art has always told the story, you know, and that story is identity and restraint, and that's how this whole thing came to be. This is the rest of the crew from
Hello.
The
museum.
I am going to do the round, so the phone is directional.
Okay. Yeah, so they were there, like, I still, like, touch them all the time because they're dog collars, and that's part of them, is that I made a decision a long time ago to not collect presentation collars because they weren't worn by a dog. They told the story of why that dog got that collar, but it wasn't like worn by a dog. And some of these collars go back to the 16th century.
I love the idea of them being inhabited by dogs. Tell me your name.
Yes, hi. I'm Elizabeth Von Hassel. I'm with the National Sporting Library Museum in Middleburg, Virginia, and we'll introduce my wonderful colleagues who are responsible for curating this incredible exhibition with Museum of the Dog here in Allen Fossil.
This is our executive director, by the way.
Yes, but I never
kill my title. Never says her title.
Say your name, though.
My name is Claudia Pfeiffer.
I'm Lauren Crowd. I'm the collections manager and registrar.
Now, Tim has talked about his passion from the point of view of a museum about sporting. What was important and exciting about acquiring the collection?
Well, there are quite a few things, and I think, you know, from looking at, you know, CEO, executive director perspective, we now have the largest collection of dog collars in the world. For us, it does fit right within our mission also in terms of looking at, you know, the history of dogs as, you know, hunting to companion dogs. It's an incredible opportunity, and we have a team that's so amazing that put together and curated this exhibition, which is now in New York, but it will then also travel to Pebble Hill in Thomasville, Georgia. So this has three locations, and it's just growing in popularity. So I'd like to have Claudia and Lauren share a little bit about curating.
Please do.
Obviously, Tim's enthusiasm is infectious. It was a wonderful opportunity for us to work with Allen, right? So when we first started looking at the idea of doing an exhibition, which was literally several years ago, all the pieces fit together. We knew each other previously, and looking at sort of the checklist of the perfect exhibition that would show artwork that would marry with the collars, really, you know, when you look at the AKC collection and the Museum of the Dog collection together, they fit that bill very nicely. So it was a natural fit to say, let's partner, let's look at traveling the exhibition from Middleburg to New York, and then look at there's another venue to take it on as well, who has the same passion for field sports that we do. So it was a really natural fit to move it to Thomasville. It's been a delight. We've all been impeded by the challenges of the pandemic, and the Museum of the Dog, like the NSLM, we've been flexible and worked around each other and got it done safely and rescheduled as we had to. We're a year later than we were originally, right? But here we are, right? So we get it done, and that was a great opportunity as well to have someone who is as flexible.
Say your name and your thoughts about it.
I'm Lauren Crowd. I'm the Senior Collections Manager and Registrar, the other half of the curatorial department at the National Sporting Library Museum. And I've just been here for the past few days helping Allen install the exhibition, getting the collars up, and just making sure everything looks up to snuff for both our organizations.
What were you thinking about in terms of displaying them? Because they are clearly functional, but you've also displayed a couple of them as if they're contemporary artworks.
That's a great point. We do have some of them out and about. Of course, the please don't touch signs. But yeah, you know, they are utilitarian objects originally, and the fact that they've survived this long, this far down, is pretty remarkable. So we're happy to have them out as long as, you know, again, people don't touch.
One of the really exciting opportunities was to look at a different way of interacting with them. So the idea of the casework to have them installed alongside of the artwork as wall units so that they're eye level as if they're interpreted individually as art objects as well was definitely a purposeful intent in terms of the design of the exhibition, that they be equal and front and center, and also topically married to one another in a lot of ways, having these great sighthound collars to look at a painting like Zilla next to it to see the physical artifacts and the artwork together was definitely something that we thought about when we designed it. I think the idea that they are truly an art form, and there was this almost incomprehensible focus on the aesthetic of the accoutrements of your companion, we get it on some level emotionally, but to see the artifacts and the purposeful care and consideration, the design, when you think about the idea that a firm like Tiffany & Company created a dog collar that was something that was very much a consumable object for people who saw that as an appropriate decoration for their loved companion and as a reflection of them as people. It's a nostalgic feeling almost.
And it seems to also resonate with Tim's idea that they feel inhabited to him.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, they're his children. I don't think he'll ever feel any differently about them. We're really honored to be stewards for them and to be able to share them with the public as well.